Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Aftermath. UFC 274, this is what we're talking about today, of course. So I'll give you my quick thoughts on the card, and then I'll show you a couple of cool bits that I spotted during the event. Quick shout-out to the sponsors for today, Canacarts. Canacarts UK is the website. Go and give them a follow on Instagram as well. This is premium quality CBD. It's absolutely fantastic. The whole cartridge as well is... ceramic, so there's no leaching of nastiness into the oil. So canacarts.uk and our other friends at Outlaw Rum, outlawrum.co.uk. Just go and check it out. It is, I mean, it's Rum Sundays, of course, but it's currently 3:15, so I haven't trained yet. So I'll hold off on the little dose of rum for the day. Okay. Quick rundown of the card. Jenny Newsom looked good. Ferny Garcia a little bit hittable. Lupita Godinez really impressed me. Every round, she just controlled it. Her wrestling looked fantastic. I kind of felt for Conor Losey. She seemed to be limited for options on the floor. I was expecting her to be able to at least instigate some more movement from the bottom position. But Godinez, you know, very, very impressive. Vergara against Rodriguez was an absolute banger and one I will definitely be returning to. Good to see Cortez get back in the win column. A very, very impressive performance there. Clear growth in a game as well, which is something we always want to see. And Fiallo's counter left hook was a thing of beauty. I'm keeping my eye on Fiallo. I didn't expect too much of him when he came into the UFC, but the way he settled in his last couple of fights, the way he started to, you know, just kind of, I mean... He's got a pace similar to Tom Breeze, you know, another very good boxer. You know, he kind of hangs out for a little while and he reads his opponent, and it will exchange if they come into his range. But it's like he takes a couple of minutes to read their range. I mean, it took him a little bit longer with Beza, but you're looking at around that, you know, 2 minute mark, he starts to settle down and find his shots, and that counter left up was lovely. Ivanov De Lima is kind of what I expect it to be. Ivanov is just a difficult dude to deal with because he's kind of a wily veteran. You know, he moves well on his feet. He's got decent boxing. He's just got very sound fundamentals. But then when you're dealing with someone like De Lima who throws as hard and as heavy as he does, and I don't know. I mean, you know, he looks in less and less conditioned. Every time I see him in there, but he's still very problematic. Okay. Before I move on, I want to quick talk about the Brandon Royval Matt Schnell fight, because this was the, for me, probably the coolest finish on the card, aside from maybe the main event, which was, of course, amazing. Now Royval is a bit of a chaotic fighter. He puts himself on the line quite a lot, and you know, sometimes he gets clipped with big shots. Sometimes it works out quite well for him because his opponent's either chasing or whatever. You know, you think back to the Kai Kara-Franz fight where he was able to catch him after a bit of a chaotic opening. Similar here with Matt Schnell. You know, we expected Matt Schnell's boxing to be sharp, which it was. You know, very clean punching, landed some nice shots. Royval hits the floor and then there's a bit of a chaotic scramble. Now, the way that this choke played out was really nice because, of course, Royval is a dangerous individual. Matt Schnell is also, you know, someone I've always enjoyed watching throughout his career. I still feel like he's going to discover better parts of his game as he moves on. But this was let's have a quick look at it. So, where are we? So this is the point where Schnell is just about to scramble back to his feet. Let me see if I can turn the brightness up on that. Okay, he's just scrambling back to his feet. Now, what you'll see him do is he rocks up, he kicks and rocks up, and he's sitting to hook around this leg here. So what he's trying to do at this point, and you'll see something similar to with Justin Gaethje in the main event, he's wrestling up onto a single leg because most of the time when you're getting up, you've got two options. You either move away from your opponent or you move into them. And now, he didn't have many options moving away because the fence is there. So moving away would have ultimately meant moving up, which would have at that point left him vulnerable to counter shots or to another level change. So even though Schnell most likely wanted to get this one back on the feet, it made sense for him to try and wrestle up out of this position. So he goes for the single leg, but unfortunately he goes head arm over one side and head on the other. So immediately, Royval's takedown defense, as you can see, he's created this kind of wedge position with his legs. He's driving his weight through his hips now into the that shoulder of Schnell. So this pressure now on this shoulder. At the same time, he's also starting to wrap this arm around. You can see he's starting to feel for that guillotine, something which, of course, he's very comfortable with. Now, as this plays out here, you can see him drop his weight on it. And then he's going to drive up off his left leg. You can see how he's tripoding here. This left leg now becomes a post, and he drives up off that leg and fires his right leg in and across the belt line of Matt Schnell. Nice little adjustment. So he's working off that drive into him. They're coming up at this point because Schnell's still driving forward. So as they drive, he posts on that leg, and it creates just enough space, as you can see, to get that right leg in and across. And then straight away he dips. He drops straight down. Leg goes over the back to control him, to hold him down for a moment. Because at this point, Schnell's got his neck wrapped, and he's got the shin across his waistline. Really what he needs to do is he needs to take his left hand and he needs to stuff that knee, which of course is a very difficult thing to do, and he's limited for space because of the cage. But if he's able to do that, it would create another scramble and he would probably be able to fight for his neck a little bit. Now, there was an adjustment here, and this is the reason why I really like this submission finish. Because what you'll notice from this position is that this is an arm in guillotine, so he's around the head with the right arm, but he's over and into the armpit on the other side, which is not, I mean, it's of course a very finishable guillotine, especially for certain individuals who've got a really good arm in guillotine. It's very, very difficult to do, especially in MMA, where people are strong and conditioned and sweaty. You know, you're better to get a real bite around the neck. Or, you know, as Jack Hermanson does with his Joker team, he gets the arm. So this arm here would actually be on the other side, which kind of locks him in a little bit. Anyway, so watch this adjustment here. So you can see the foot here. So that's the leg of Brandon Royval. And then he's also locking him down with the other one. So you can see there's a control posture here. But he releases it for a moment. So what he's going to do, he's going to take this left leg and he's going to bring it down. He's going to post it on the floor again here. Now, the reason why he's doing this is because this arm in guillotine is not tight enough. You can see right now that Matt Schnell's got both of his hands on the floor, one here and one here. But he's still got an arm inside this guillotine. There's still space in there where he can use that strength to drive that space open, which is why, of course, a no-arm guillotine is always preferable for the attacker. So watch what he does here. So he takes his foot off, he plants it on the floor, and he pushes to drive himself deeper. And as you see this motion here, you're going to see in this little pocket here, his hand pop up through. He goes deep, and there's his hand. You can see it there. Let me just move the circle. So now his hands pop through. So what that's telling you is now that the neck, either side of the neck, is on the bicep and forearm. So he's gone really deep. So this hand is now across his stomach here. He's obviously got a lot more weight on the back head, at the back of the head of Matt Schnell. But for a moment, he releases the grip. This is just controlling. He's just holding onto him here, just so he doesn't posture up and lose this, while he's getting a better bite on the neck. And then he's going to release this. He's going to throw the leg over for control. He's going to release the hand around the arm. And as he does, you can see Matt Schnell's actually tapping already before he goes to this. And he just goes, he's got the hand here, and he's pushing up. It's almost like a, well, it's not quite, he's pushing this way. But this is a very popular guillotine position to finish because it closes this space here where the neck is. So that additional little drive that he's got there is putting an extra kind of scissor, like pincher motion on the neck of Matt Schnell. But it was deep enough. The thing I like about this is it was deep enough to get him tapping before his hands were together. We talk about Brian Ortega having a real good squeeze, but this is very good. It's good mechanics as well, because as he dips to the side and drives his arm even deeper through, you can see there as his fingers come through here. You can see how much deeper that guillotine is, But then as he moves back, as he circles his hips back and throws his left leg back over to control the back, it also pulls Maxnell down. So he's driving down into the back of this hand now. So it's almost like he's locking it in with his opponent's weight. And he squeezes. No hands together at this point, because you can see his fingertips here and you can see his other hand there. And then he releases the hand. And he's going under the underside of his little finger and driving in. And what you'll see from this angle is this is the point where he lets go. The tapping hand of Maxnell is already moving, ready to tap before he's connected these two together. That's how tight of a squeeze it is. But you can also see much better there the angle around the neck of Maxnell and why that was so tight. Tapping with both hands. Really nice finish that was. Really nice finish. Let me have a quick drink. Okay, what's next? Macy Chasson looked good. I thought her footwork was much better. Far more mobile and not quite as easy to read. Norma Dumont, I felt like she kind of started to find her rhythm towards the end of the 15 minutes, which wasn't ideal for her. She needed to make a faster start, but that was difficult because Macy was, you know, her footwork was good. She was constantly changing the range between the two of them. And because she's so tall and rangy, you know, you don't really know when she can reach you. You know, you kind of get used to the length of your own arms, but then when you fight someone taller, you're like, now my range is all out. And it felt like that for Norma Dumont. And what is going on with Francisco Trinaldo? I mean, he is flying the flag for 40-year-olds, isn't he? Making me feel good about myself. I mean, what is he, 43? How he didn't stop Danny Roberts is amazing. It's really a testament to Danny Roberts' toughness. But some of the shots he hit him with, even the shots to the body, like rocketing that left hook into the body, you can imagine how under pressure Danny Roberts felt. And I will say there was a small victory for Danny Roberts towards the end of the fight where he pushed back against Francisco Trinaldo. And that is not something I've seen from Danny Roberts before. I know he's tough and I know he's willing to stay in the fight for as long as it takes. But he struggles to kind of bring that resurgence in his game towards the end of the rounds. And sometimes it pays off. I mean, against Trinaldo, It just wasn't quite enough, but you know it is the way it is, you know. And I could quite easily see Trinaldo and Randy Brown throwing down next. Was it Randy Brown? Chaos Williams won, didn't it? Hang on a minute, I've got the results up here. Where are we? Yeah, I could quite easily see that those two throwing down next. I mean, it was Trinaldo is just one of those guys. He's kind of a pest in the division. Doesn't matter who they're matching with. He's always going to be problematic because he's tough and he's durable and he's wily. You know, he's been doing this for a long time. So he's 28-8 is his record now. He's a bit of a Glover Teixeira in that sense, where he's got a good foundational game and he's just now confident that he can apply it. And you know, since he's moved up to welterweight as well, I feel like that kind of accentuates his toughness. It accentuates his ability to take a punch. You could see him start to move back up the rankings at any point soon. I should pull the rankings up, actually. OSP Shogun was kind of a weird one for me. Like, I think anybody that watched the podcast, you know, I talked about the OSP Shogun situation and the fact that Shogun, you can tell he wants to fight, you can tell he loves to fight, you can also tell that the career that he's had has started to, you know, wear on him. He doesn't look the same physical athlete that he used to. For now, I'm not speculating as to why, but certainly age is a big part of that drop off. You go back to when he was fighting in Pride in his 20s and he was vicious, and he's always had that edge to his game. You know, all the shootbox guys did. It was kind of the signature of the gym. You know, Shogun's brother Ninja is the same. You know, vicious, aggressive, got that crazy eyes. I never ever see that from OSP. You know, he's a big athlete. He's got a few weapons that he's quite comfortable with using. Of course, the Von Fluchoke, but he never looks comfortable in there to me. And that was just kind of a cagey one because Shogun wants to push forward and wants to fight. but he doesn't have the same kind of pace that he used to. And then every time he steps into range, he's dealing with someone that can take his head off with one really unusually directed punch. Kind of a weird one for me. Like, Shogun's got one more fight, he said. That was his second to last fight, and then he's retiring. I'm going to be really interested to see who they match him up with, because I hope it's a favorable matchup, in the sense that he's got a really good chance of having a really good performance. and it's not, I mean, that could have been just as bad as the first fight, where, you know, what was the meme, Jamie, where it looked like he slipped on a skateboard? Oh, and he run forward and slip on, you know, it was a really odd punch, like circled off, kind of winged around the side, exactly the same punch almost exactly the same punch that OSP used against Menafield, but that one was a little bit straighter, a little bit more stinging. I don't know, it's a weird one for Shogun. I hope he gets someone that's kind of, you know, around the same stage of their career, if there is such a person. Okay. How are we doing, Jamie? Is anybody watching?
Yeah, it's 926.
Oh, is there really? Look at you, Sunday afternooners. Oh, we hit 1,000. Hello, everybody. Hello, 1,000 people on a Sunday afternoon. I appreciate you all joining us. We will try and do these a bit more regularly. We have very busy days over here. Sparring was 8 a.m. this morning. Not for me. That's why I'm still smiling. Okay. Michael Chandler. So, I actually thought Tony looked really good in the first round. I thought he's, you know, a lot of the things I spoke about in the Raw War Room, you know, going back to his nice straight punches, he's dipping out and counter punching, and, you know, his elbows. I mean, he did try and smash him with an elbow in the opening seconds, which was probably a little bit too much of a risk. But, you know, that's Tony Ferguson for you. I thought he looked all right in the first round, and I think he felt like he looked all right in the first round, because at the end of it, he had a swagger to, you know, walking back to his corner. Now, the thing is with Chandler, is that long stance always makes him vulnerable for low kicks, and Tony did invest in low kicks a bit, but it was the hands of Ferguson that I thought looked really good. He's always going to have really kind of odd, awkward movement. That's just the way that Tony moves, and that's part of the challenge of dealing with him. But then on the flip side, you've got Chandler, who's 0-60, is unlike many other people in this division. And the front kick that he landed was beautiful. And this is something that I will say, because I see a lot of people using these kicks in sparring, and there are a few times when people have won fights with this kick. Of course, Anderson Silva, Vitor Belfort, is in my opinion the best version, because he set it up beautifully. Vitor was blocking an inside low kick, which is what Anderson had sold him with his eye line. I think I did this on one of the UFC breakdown shows back in the day. Like, he looked down in his lead leg and he flicked his leg as if he was going to kick it, and then went straight to the head. Beautiful. Then I think it was a couple of weeks later, we got Machida knocking out Randy's front tooth in his retirement fight. Again, another beautiful kick. A couple that I can think of, though, was it was Travis Brown fighting Alistair Overeem, and I think he'd landed a couple of really good shots, and Overeem was a bit dazed, and then all of a sudden Overeem snap front kicks him in the face and puts him out. But then if you watch that fight straight away after, as Overeem puts his foot down, he realizes his toe's not in the right place, and the doctor comes in and replaces it. Now, something that I always used to get told when I was doing Taekwondo is, so in obviously in Muay Thai we have the teep kick, which is a push, and it's with the ball of the foot. So if they're my toes, that's the ball of the foot. That's the part I'm aiming for. And often I see people snapping with their toes down, like this kind of limp. That's where you're going to do damage to your foot. It's where you're going to hyperextend your ankle, perhaps break your toes. You need to make sure that you're pulling your toes all the way back so you hit him with the underside of the foot. And that is one of the best things about what Chandler did. He snapped the front kick to the point where he was able to pull his toes back and hit underneath the side of the chin with the ball of the foot. I mean, you know, it's kind of one of those things. I'm not overseeing Tony Ferguson make the walk yet. I would still like to see him fight. It would be sad if he got released at this point. I don't think he'll get released. I think they'll keep a hold of him and they'll give him horrible matchups because of all the trashy talk going into fight week. But, you know, like, I want to see Tony similar to Shogun. I want to see him matched, you know, favorably with his kind of generation. I mean, you know, I think we can agree now that Tony's not where he is or who he used to be. But it doesn't mean that, you know, you go a bit further down the UFC rankings or even just outside the top 15 and there's not some really interesting fights down there for him. You know, and even guys like, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing Tony Ferguson go up a weight class. I wouldn't mind seeing him face RDA. I wouldn't mind seeing him take on, who else was I going to say? There was someone else that came to mind then. Someone just outside the top 15. Well, you put some suggestions in the comments because that's a part of the interactivity of the show. I kind of look at the top 15 and it's, of course it's not been updated yet, but I don't really want to see Tony taking on any of these monsters that are coming through like a Gillespie or a Fiziev or a Sarukian or a Gamrot. Like, you know, maybe a Brad Riddell would be a decent fight. Diego Fajeia would be a fun fight, you know. Again, might be a little bit risky. Tony has spoken about going up to welterweight. I wouldn't mind seeing him at welterweight against RDA. I mean, you know, take the weight cut off these guys and maybe look after their brain a bit in that way. What we have to realize is, and of course I've been kind of having these conversations a bit myself, what with, you know, myself having a boxing match coming up, and same thing with Ricky Hatton, and we've got a really cool interview coming up on the channel soon about that. Like, you have to remember that, like, if this is what we do, this is what we do. We love competing. And the most important thing about professional competition is that it's safe and it's sanctioned and the athletes are looked after. That often requires them getting matched appropriately. And often, like, if Nate Diaz gets Chimaev in his last fight, that is, it almost feels like the UFC have ordered a hitman on him, because it's not a fair fight to give him because of who he is. Like, he's got so much scar tissue. He's a 155er that's fighting a guy that's somewhere between welterweight and middleweight. Like, it's an assassination attempt. And what it will do is it will do physical damage to him, but it will also do brand damage to him, because then when he goes on to somewhere else and he doesn't sign his contract, then he's worth less in the eyes. That's kind of the UFC's MO. They'll try and kind of filter you out quickly at the back end to make sure that your role in value is not great. Same with Anderson Silva, and this has been spoken about a lot recently. Like, we may watch the same thing happen to Tony Ferguson. We need to be careful that it doesn't happen to Cowboy as well, which was a real shame he wasn't on the card. Like, Tony Ferguson against Joe Lauzon, why not? I would watch that fight. Why not? Have we got any... have we got some questions? Okay, what else have I got to talk about? I've got a couple of things to talk about before we move on to questions. Anyway, so yeah, Tony, you know, I still enjoy Tony's fights. I still think that, you know, one elbow in the right direction, the one level change in the wrong timing from Chandler, and that could have been a different fight. And it was, you know, it was a great first round and a great finish from Michael Chandler, who is always going to be in that top echelon of the division until he retires. Again, you know, physical specimen, lots of experience, very dynamic game. Good to see at least one of those guys get back in the win column. Okay, the co-main event. So, this was a really odd fight. It was really weird because I've gone through and I've looked at the stats as well, because I'm always interested to see what the actual statistics, the dude with the button sitting there going click click, that's a takedown, that's a strike, that's significant, that's not significant. I don't know how much we can buy into this stuff. And I've watched this fight. I watched it and I've watched it double speed. And the reason I watch it double speed is because it gives me a bit better of a perspective of who's controlling the octagon, because it's not necessarily the person pushing forward. This is something we have to remember about octagon control. Is octagon control doesn't mean that you've got your opponent pushed up against the fence. There were a lot of fights where Lyoto Machida had octagon control as he was moving laterally on the back foot. A good counter striker will pull you into range to hit you with shots. Anderson Silva against Forrest Griffin, same thing. Drew him through the center of the octagon. Bam, bam, dropped him. Octagon control doesn't mean the one being the bully. It's not always the case. And what you'll notice when you watch the fight with the Rose fight in double speed is that she's the one that's ebbing and flowing out of range. And you'll see every now and then Esparza will bite and Rose will move away. And then she'll move back into range, Esparza will bite and she'll get hit with a jab. The other thing as well is the impact and the targeting of the strikes as well. So let's just have a quick look at this first. Let's see if you can see this. Okay. Is that visible, Jamie? What do you reckon? Well, I'll talk you through it anyway. So first round, and I need to change the color of this. First round is, I mean, four strikes to four strikes, no takedowns. I mean, literally identical. So for me, then it falls back onto octagon control. For me, I thought that Rose was the one that was in the... She was the one that was doing the pushing and pulling in my eyes. She was the one that was controlling the direction of the fight, the pace of the fight. And when Esparza was able to move forward and what she was moving onto, whether she was moving into space or whether she was getting stung in the process. Next round, I mean, you know, there's really not much in it, but Esparza failed a takedown. I mean, some people will consider in a tight round that the attempt of getting a takedown is scorable. I don't know. You also can't score anything for Rose for defending the takedown because defense is its own reward, so that kind of cancels itself out. So that was kind of a weird one. And then, you know, Rose landed 3 of 14 and Carl landed 4 of 22. So then, you know, what was that additional strike? Was it worth scoring the round for her? You know, was that one jab and three low kicks compared to three overhands? You know, these are the things that we've got to break down. And then you also go to success rate. You know, Rose was holding steady at 21% success rate compared to Esparza, whose success rate now has dropped off, which shows that Rose changing range and changing distance is starting to pay off. Okay. Rose starts to pick it up a little bit here. She now throws more strikes and lands a couple more strikes. She also stuffs three takedowns, giving Carla no control on the ground. Another decent round for Rose, in my opinion. I mean, every single one of these rounds could have been... You could make an argument one way or the other. And to be honest, if I was sitting in a room full of judges, I would love to debate this fight because like your perspective of what's going on, when it comes down to the minor details... It makes the difference between a 10-9 and 10-9 one way and a 10-9 the other. And, you know, you score two rounds one way and you're already stacking the odds in one fighter's favor because then they only have to win one of the next three rounds. You know, for me, and let me just clear this because let's focus on the last two rounds. So striking wise, it was pretty even in the last couple of rounds, but Esparza was scored for two takedowns here. I guess you could score one of those as a takedown, but Rose's escaping for me was enough to show that Carla didn't really have much of a control in that. There was a moment where it stalled on the floor before Rose then initiated the escape. So like no control there. And then Rose comes out in the last round and puts it on her. And really good reacting to her corner team as well. Trevor Whitman said to her at the end of the fourth, he said, "You're better than her everywhere. Go and show it," or something along those lines. You know, go and prove it. And she did. I mean, she outpointed her. She landed more than double strikes in the last round and she took her down. I personally would have been inclined to score that to Rose, but I could see three rounds going to Carla. I could make that argument for you as well. Me personally, and what I'm looking for in a fight are more meaningful shots, more damaging shots. Neither of them really landed any, but I would say that Rose was more successful with the more balance changing, fight altering strikes, and Carla did nothing sufficient with her wrestling to really. I don't know. She didn't do anything with her wrestling enough for me to score any rounds for her. If you're going to win a round with wrestling, you need to take the fight down and then do something on the floor. Like in a very, very tight round, you can score a takedown and control the person for 30 seconds. And, you know, maybe that will win you the round. But MMA judging is changing. You know, it's a lot more about damage now. Sometimes they'll score the person in bottom position for just working harder with elbows and strikes than the person in top position clinging. You know, you've really got to have direction with your wrestling if you're going to do it in MMA. So I thought that was interesting, you know, because of how close it was. But also, you know, look, if you look at the percentages, you know, the only round where Esparza had more success with striking was in the fourth round, and she scored two takedowns. So yeah, I mean, I can go fourth round to Esparza, but the last one for Rose and the first three are very, very debatable. And then going on to, you know, just to kind of continue on with that point, I thought this was interesting because this is the breakdown of significant strikes. So Rose landed 81% of her strikes to the head compared to Carla, who landed 50% of strikes to the head. So then if we remember how close those rounds were, and, you know, sometimes we had both of them scoring four strikes a round, you've then got to go, okay, well, Rose is landing more headshots. For me, that's more significant. You can do damage with low kicks, of course, but head strikes are fight-ending strikes. You know, for me, low kicks, body shots, they can, of course, be finishers, but your intention to finish is aiming for the head. And Carla also landed 36% of her shots to the legs as well. So again, you know, unless it's like a Rakic against Anthony Smith, where it like knocks them off balance, or you can physically see like a limp, you know, DJ against Cejudo. Like, for me, that, okay, you go, okay, that was a significant strike. It's very, very difficult to land a significant low kick. Far more likely, including the takedown defense and the strike on the break from Rose, there was far more value for me in the strikes of Rose. But I am interested to see what everybody thinks of that, because of course it was a very, very closely contested fight. Okay. Main event. So first of all, of course, we need to quick cover the scales situation, and it needs fixing, because everybody all the way through fight week uses digital scales. Most fighters travel with digital scales. If they're using scales in a doctor's, almost always now it's going to be a digital scale. I don't know why commissions are still using these mechanical scales, especially because they have to be moved and recalibrated and moved and recalibrated, and they're doing it with a 20 kilo kettlebell from the hotel gym, and it's just a mess. It doesn't need to necessarily be such a mess. If you're so unsure, get two sets of scales from different brands and have them both on the stage at the same time. Like, we should have the digital scale readout, so everybody can see when they step on the scale what the scale is. So there's no commissioner that's not weighed anybody in since 1964, and he's doing this tapping on the little. I've been there. I've seen it. Like, that they spend ages. Like, nah. No, and they don't really exactly know what they're doing. Like, that needs to be completely taken out of the equation. We don't need that anymore. Like, the variance of a digital scale is going to be marginal compared to the mistakes that humans would make doing a job that they don't do every week. If you can have someone that weighs people in properly every weekend, then of course. But then those people can be lent on to make sure people make weight when they maybe not. And the other thing as well that you'll see with mechanical scales is that they have to settle. Like, you have to see them go dun 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 dun, and then settle between that. If you don't see that settle and stationary, that person's not made weight. And very often we'll see this dun 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 dun, and then they just slide the weight down. Yep, made weight. Bang, done. Bullshit. Let's sort this out, because it's a mess. Like, I'm not mentioning any specific moments, but let me tell you, there are times when people have not made weight and they've been cleared to make weight. And then there are times when people may have made weight and then stepped on scales, and the mechanical scales of the variance is half a pound or whatever. Now, of course, we get the pound allowance, but when it comes to championship fights, you don't get that. And we just need to make sure. I'm not saying that Charles didn't make weight. I don't know, to be honest. But from what I understand, is he was of the understanding that he made weight in the back. He was on the weight on the scales in the back. And as Chandler said, like to think you've made weight and to go through that emotion of, oh, I've done it, made it, and then you step on the scales and now you think you haven't. It's exhausting. It really. I mean, there's one time in my career where I didn't make weight, and it was when I fought Chris Lytle, and I'd made weight at the hotel. I'd stepped on the digital scales. I was on weight. We traveled to the venue, which was unfortunately a tent in Milwaukee in summer, and it was red hot in the back. And we're all sitting in the tent around the back waiting for the weigh-ins to start, and I'm sweating still. Like, so I feel like I'm now underweight. So everyone's like sipping a bit of water and stuff, and I end up stepping on the scales, and I was hot. I was like 200 grams over 171. And you're like, that the emotion that you go, oh, not, like in that moment where you want to just go and recover and replenish and rehydrate, you all of a sudden go, fuck, I've got to get my sweats on and get jumping the rope, or I've got to start running around this bloody field, or I've got to go and get back in the sauna. It's exhausting mentally. So we need to make sure that is tidied up. It's just weird to see that happen. I mean, of course, you know, you want people to step on the scales and make weight, but we also want to make sure that process of fighters making weight is nice and clean and tidy, and that there's no madness with the scales and knocking the bloody weight up and down, because I've just seen it too many times. Digital scales, take humans out of the equation. Get two sets, get three sets. I don't give a damn. Digital scales is the way forward. Okay, about his performance. Now, as I said in the breakdown, he is hittable. He does get hit with big shots, and we saw that. You know, he got cut, he got damaged. That is the kind of thing that Conor McGregor, sitting on his super Lamborghini yacht, drinking his proper 12, he's going to be watching and going, if I landed that shot, he'd be unconscious. And then that story will continue spinning in McGregor's head, and then he'll manage to talk himself into a title shot. So don't be surprised if we get that fight, especially because he got acknowledged by Charles in the interview. It might also make it easier, the fact that the title is vacant. I don't know. I mean, of course, it would be weird McGregor just stepping back in and getting a title shot. But if the title's vacant, there's a bit of obscurity there. There's a narrative that could be spun on that for sure. But who knows? But Oliveira is just, I mean, he's fantastic, isn't he? Let's be honest. His skills all round are really, really great. As V mentioned in the Pits podcast, I am concerned maybe his eyesight is affecting his ability to get out of the way of punches, though, because I don't know. He just seems very, very hittable. And even if he's able to do that against McGregor and take more shots, and he's able to do that against whoever else in the division and take more shots, there comes a point when that does run out. You know, I mean, you look at some of the guys further down the division, some of these guys coming on. Like, if Oliveira wins his belt back and then defends it, say, once more, like, maybe he wins it back in a fight against McGregor, and then he rematches Chandler and beats Chandler. Who's coming through next? I mean, is it going to be a Fazeev or someone like that can just take his head clean off? Every time he takes these big shots, there's a depletion of longevity. So that's something he has to be concerned about. He can't keep going through the ringer like this, even if it's just, you know, even if it's a short fight. But the actual finish itself was fantastic. You know, so he lands a clean knockdown. I'm going to show you a couple of images here. Trying not to get in too much trouble. Okay, so in the clinch here, again, about the right hand, there were a few things that I said in the breakdown show which fortunately came to fruition, which shows research pays off. So his right hand coming up the channel and over the center, over the top, is a real value to him. And the way he punches through the target is really nice. Pings Gaethje right on the edge of his chin, and Gaethje goes down. Now, this is important for a couple of reasons. Partly because of Gaethje, how he falls, and how he responds when he falls. Because if you remember what Matt Schnell did, he sat up to a single leg, which is exactly what Gaethje does. The positioning and the spatial awareness of Charles Oliveira is what I'm watching here, and how slick it is. So watch how he moves in here. Hang on, let me fade to black. So Gaethje's rocking himself up. He's taken a clean shot. He's gone down. He's a bit dazed. He can see Charles Oliveira rushing towards him, but we don't know how much comprehension he has of this being UFC 274 and his name being Justin and his opponent's name being Charles. We don't know his ability to understand the moment. So what we can assume is that he's kicking straight back into what's familiar to him, which is wrestling back up to a good position. So as he sits up here, you'll see he immediately goes to wrap the leg. This underhook comes through. Hang on a minute, different color. Let's go back to white. So he comes under this leg. What he's trying to do is he's trying to grab that leg and get on a single and wrestle himself back up into a strong position. But as Charles Oliveira is stepping in, he's leaving this leg here, which works perfectly for him because it stays in between Justin Gaethje's legs as he sits up. The next thing you're going to see is Charles Oliveira's right knee dropping down behind Justin Gaethje and acting like a wedge. So Gaethje has partially turned himself here. He's gone under the leg. The hooks come in. And now that stays attached to Justin Gaethje's leg through the whole rest of the process. You'll also notice that the right leg is there. So he's got a wedge up against his back. So it's going to be very difficult for him to now start turning back towards Charles Oliveira. What he really needs to do is clear this leg. Hang on one second. Justin needs to clear this leg and get his arm back so he can start creating some space, because he's already in the process now of getting wrapped up. So watch this. Watch. Just pay attention to this leg here. Watch how as Gaethje starts to move to try and turn towards Oliveira, Oliveira's leg just stays hooked and just follows that leg, almost pushes him towards the back. See how it's close here? In fact, let's try this. I make this up on the spot, so please bear with me. So the leg's there. A little bit of movement. Now the leg's there. A little bit of movement. Oh, now the leg's there. So he's stayed hooked into Gaethje's leg as he's moved. He's dragged it with him. And what you'll see from the other position is the arm is still here for Gaethje, but the leg is also still there. So Oliveira's got one whole side of his body wrapped up now. And the direction of Oliveira's spine kind of shows you the direction he wants to go. He's going around the back of Justin Gaethje. And this next move is very, very nice. So you're going to see him post up on his right leg. He's going to get a bit of space. He's posted up. And now he's going to swing this leg, and it's going to come all the way around here and hook in on the far side. Here he goes. He kicks it off. And it swings. And he goes straight over and hooks into the other side of his opponent. Now as he falls back, what you'll see is the leg hook that he had originally is now over the arm and shoulder of Gaethje, and the other one is underneath his arm. So he's now in a reverse triangle position, which of course there are a multitude of threats here from Justin Gaethje. If Justin Gaethje gets his left back arm into play, then Charles Oliveira is already on his back. If Justin Gaethje keeps his head inside, then these legs are going to become triangles, and Justin Gaethje's caught in a triangle again, which of course is going to give him flashbacks. If he manages to get his head clear and get his head underneath this leg of Charles Oliveira, then Charles has got this arm. So there's a three option attack here, depending on which way Justin Gaethje goes. He can let him have the arm and jump on his back. He can stay here and try and cinch up the triangle, and if the triangle's not working, bang, armbar. Beautiful three-piece combo. And as he's here as well, because you'll see what Charles Oliveira is doing, he's hooked around the arm. He actually starts to land some really meaningful elbows, which, just to make most of the position, were really, really nice. But look at this clamp he's got on here. You can see leg over here, controlled, leg around the side, wrapped around, bound with the arms. Lovely, lovely control position. Now the next transition is really nice. So he throws a few elbows, and then Justin Gaethje pushes him back, and he cinches up this triangle here. So you can see now how tight this is for Gaethje. Like, that's a really, really bad position for him, because of course now he's starting to feel pressure into his neck, but his arm is still vulnerable. There's still a possibility that that arm's going to get snagged and hyperextended. So Gaethje's trying to rock up here. You can see him turning his knees away. He's trying to turn this way, trying to get back to his knees so he can do something. And Oliveira feels it. So he comes up onto this elbow. I mean, I'm breaking this down into like minute details, but every single one of these stages, there's such a purposeful movement to each part that you've got to appreciate all together. So he's keeping the triangle on. He's pushing off this arm, and he's going up in this direction now. He's going back over to the other side of Justin Gaethje. And what I want you to bear in mind is that this leg here, which is Charles Oliveira's right leg, is going to go from being the bottom leg of the triangle to the near side hook, which takes some figuring out. So what he's going to do here is still got a control of this wrist. He's pushing up onto this shoulder, and he's going to drive himself over. He's going to drive himself over Justin Gaethje. See that drive off the arm. And as he does that, he starts to straighten this leg here, which also aids the movement and starts to push Justin Gaethje. But as, right on the camera angle change, as he lets go of this arm of Justin Gaethje, he fires this leg straight, and that puts him square on his back. And then we see a similar circling motion with the opposite leg this time. So the right leg, which is here, is now going to hook in and become the near side hook on Justin Gaethje. And then the other leg is the one that swings over this time. But this time he locks up the body triangle instead. And the process of locking this in as well, if you see from the other angle, like the main priority here for Justin Gaethje right now is to grab this top hand here. If he can grab this top hand and peel it off, he's going to buy himself a moment where he can start moving the rest of his body, maybe pass that wrist to one and then start peeling the one off around his neck. Still very difficult to do, of course. But watch how Charles Oliveira locks it in, because you can see Gaethje reaching for it now. He's trying to pull it down. But what Charles Oliveira is doing is he's driving his head into the side of his own hand to keep it locked in. And from the other angle, you'll see how he clears the hands there. Gaethje pulls down, and he just snatches the arm back and goes straight back to it. Digs it deep behind his head. Now you can't even see his glove. Goes deep behind his head, and then look how he turns his cheekbone and his shoulder, in his head into it. So that space there is now squeezed, completely gone. And now Justin Gaethje would have to push his head away to create space for that arm to come over, which, of course, is impossible. Okay, we've got some questions, Jamie? Yeah. Okay, let's have some questions then.
So we had a $5 donation from Shifty Powers.
Thank you, Shifty Powers, for the $5 donation. I need to read these questions, don't I? Because we've not got you a mic either yet. That was something we was in the feedback. Okay, what's the question?
So why doesn't Gaethje use body kicks, knees, rolling thunders anymore? He's not versatile. I know I needed to change, said post Alvarez Poirier losses.
Okay, so why doesn't he use body kicks and rolling thunder and
knees?
So why has Chandler started to limit his game a little bit? It's a difficult question to answer, to be honest, because I kind of don't know. Usually what happens when people start losing parts of their game is because of either an inability to actually physically do it. He could have an injury, he could have an ankle or a knee injury, especially after the Gaethje fight. You know, there might be.
It was Gaethje.
Yeah. Oh, why does Gaethje not do that stuff anymore? Yeah. Oh, okay. Right. I thought we were talking about Chandler. So, Gaethje not throwing body kicks against Oliveira was smart because he would have gotten them wrapped up. I think, to be honest, it's such an expenditure of energy, and now Gaethje has felt the reality of being tired. That's where there's going to be some hesitation there. Like being gassed in a fight is awful, and you feel very vulnerable. And Gaethje had made it almost all the way through his career and into the UFC. Well, he made it all the way through his career and into the UFC without getting punished without getting punished for getting tired in a fight. But then against Alvarez and against Poirier, he did get tired and he did get hurt. And I think that after that, he may have started to pull back some of the more chaotic or the higher energy parts of his game, so he wasn't expending that unnecessary energy. I mean, the energy that it would take to throw one body kick, you could probably get three decent punches off. And I know that like energy expenditure doesn't work that way necessarily, but there is, like, it's why it makes no sense when someone's tired, why do you throw a spinning kick? Like Chris Weidman, Rockhold, you know, he won the first couple of rounds, he came out, threw a spinning kick, and lost the fight and the belt. You know, people do silly things when they get tired, and it's a really simple lesson that people should learn early in their career. In order to throw a spinning kick, especially an effective one, say it's going to take 8 units of energy. If you're tired, take those 8 units of energy and have 8 jabs that might get you out of trouble and give you some space to get your lungs back. Like, for whatever reason, people fall into the idea that they're going to land some Jet Li shit as soon as they're the most tired they've ever been in their life. And it just doesn't happen. I mean, it's so, so rare that something like that lands, even when someone's fresh and has set it up. I think Gaethje, especially after those losses, became less chaotic and more focused on what is most damaging, which you know, is his hands and his low kicks. You know, he doesn't need to step outside of that because, you know, say if he did like Rolling Thunder or threw a body kick or whatever at Charles Oliveira, he's opening doors for him that he doesn't need to do, especially, you know, if he sticks to his basics, good takedown offense, good boxing and good low kicks. I just think it's like a smart shedding of a piece in his game. I'm not saying we won't see it again in the future, but I think it would have to be against a lesser opponent.
So, this is from Bob.
Oh, hang on a minute. Someone knocking at the door. Do you want to go and grab that? I've got a question here, Jim. You go and let him in. What have I got here? Oh, Jamie's squeezing past. The key's hanging on the door, Jamie.
Okay.
Do you still feel Islam has a chance? Is he the only one not scared to go to the ground with Charles, and how do you see that playing out? It feels like it's the only fight that makes sense. Yeah, I agree. I do kind of feel like it's the only fight that makes sense, especially if you look down the division and you kind of see that the rest of the guys need a bit of time before they get up there and they're kind of worthy of a shot, which is why we're having a conversation about maybe Chandler coming back around for another one. For me, Makhachev is the closest to a title shot out of everybody in the division because of the way that he's winning fights, his absolute dominance, the fact that he might have a counterpart to the game of Charles Oliveira. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, I'm constantly impressed with Charles Oliveira. Go for it, Jamie. Amazon. Okay. What else we got, Jamie? What are the questions we got?
Right, so from Bob.
Bob?
Yeah.
Hello, Bob.
Apparently Gilbert Burns said that Charles's BJJ is not considered one of the best, but in MMA, his BJJ is the best. Could you explain that?
Okay, so Gilbert Burns said that Charles Oliveira's BJJ game is not considered to be like world elite by comparison to other BJJ practitioners.
In MMA,
it is. Yeah. I mean, it's just a very different thing. It's you know, like when you see people competing in jiu-jitsu competitions, they're obviously dealing with one very restricted skill set, same as you would if you were boxing or something like that. Now, that requires you to first of all be familiar with the differences with gi and no gi. I mean, of course, he could probably excel in no gi, but then he's going to be competing against people that are purposefully trying to nullify what he's doing. Now, in MMA, there are ways to open those doors. You know, he can level change and attack somebody and climb up them as they're escaping, or not even take them down, climb up them as they're defending his takedown, or he can knock them down with a shot and then jump on them. There also is the benefit of the fence. You know, like the his ability to take people down against the fence, to tangle people up against the fence. Same with Khabib. You know, there's wrestling and there's wrestling for MMA. There's jiu-jitsu and jiu-jitsu for MMA. You know, there's boxing and there's boxing for MMA. It's a different thing. Every time you add a facet to the game, every time you change something about it, it changes the way that things are applied. Like, as soon as you take away kicks, striking changes ranges. It changes the stance. It changes your options when you're stepping into strike. If you take away knees, then you can level change lower. And, you know, there's lots and lots of different things that change. And if you go back to someone like Gunnar Nelson, one of the reasons why he's so successful at taking and controlling people's backs and looking for rear naked chokes is because he opens it up with strikes. You know, very purposeful, mean strikes, mean and meaningful. Like GSP has great wrestling for MMA, Charles Oliveira's jiu-jitsu game has been refined and refined to mixed martial arts, and he wouldn't be the jiu-jitsu player in MMA that he is had he not develops his striking game just the same. You know, his striking game is always underestimated. That right hand that he knocked Gaethje down with was the beginning of the end. You know, he may not have been able to wrap it up nearly as quickly if he'd not hurt him with that first shot. So there are so many other elements that play into MMA jiu-jitsu, and so many things that just kind of fall by the wayside. You watch professional grappling, and a lot of time they're trying to steal each other's socks. It's like this tumbling around for like, you know, trying to tie each other's shoelaces or something. It's very frustrating to watch. In an MMA situation, even a combat jiu-jitsu situation, one person gets in top position and they'll land shots that will change the your options. I think Charles has developed a very, very strong game for MMA. But I also think, you know, if you put him into a no-gi competition, he's going to do well against almost everybody aside from that elite handful in the world.
Shadow King.
Yep.
Who would you want Gaethje to fight next?
The Shadow King. Who would I want Gaethje to fight next? You know, I wouldn't mind seeing Gaethje fight Beneil Dariush. I don't think that'd be a bad fight at all. I also wouldn't mind seeing him fight Rafael Dos Anjos. You know, the thing is with Gaethje's style, you can match him against anybody and he's going to bring the best out of them and they're going to bring the best out of him, because as long as they come to fight, it's going to be a good one. I mean, you know, it's going to get to the stage where, especially now Gaethje's lost two title shots, he's probably going to have to win two or three to get himself back into this position. He might find himself opening the door for someone like a Gregor Gillespie or a Fiziev or a Gamrot, you know, or a Sarukian, you know, like these. But you're looking at strong wrestlers there, Gillespie and Sarukian in particular, very, very strong wrestlers. Gamrot, much more of an MMA-based game with great submissions, but great striking as well. You know, you watch his fight against Goram Khatadzeladze, who's another one in this division that is just flying under the radar right now. He's not even in the top 15, but you've got to keep an eye on Goram. He's a lethal individual. I think there are lots of good options for Gaethje, but he's got to be smarter about the way he picks his opponents now, because he can't just kind of go through the ringer again because of his fighting style. You know, he does get hit and hurt. He does get bloodied. He can't be doing five fights before he gets a title shot. He needs to pick his opponents. Like, if I was him, if I was his management, I wouldn't go any lower than RDA. And RDA is at number six. Like, everybody above that, I'd say Dariush or RDA. They're my two picks. I probably wouldn't want him to fight anybody else if I was his management. And then maybe, you know, a Poirier to try and get a title shot again. But he can't be taking too many more fights because he takes too many shots. Okay. Any more questions?
Yeah, I mean, Alexis Tremblay.
Yep, Alexis Tremblay.
How do you think Oliveira would fare at welterweight?
I think that's a good question. The question was, how would Oliveira fare at welterweight? I think it's a good question. I also will draw your attention to when he bumped into Kamaru Usman, and it was a little bit frosty. It was a little bit frosty. Like Usman, of course, he had his sunglasses on and he had his fancy shirt on, and it was difficult to read because there wasn't really much of an exchange, but there was definitely a bit of a frostiness to it. I could quite easily see Oliveira moving up. And, you know, he might be healthier again moving up a weight class. Like, I know, of course, he was a 145er, but the difference in him in his health and his performances since he's moved up, he might be able to make that jump again. It's just a shame, you know, we keep coming back to this same thing. It's just a shame that there's not the weight class in between. Because, you know, a stop off around 162, even if it's just a catch weight, and just call it catch weight for the time being, there are good fights to be made there. Like, you could put Oliveira against Covington at a catch weight at 162-ish, 162, 163. And that again, would be a really good one. We're a bit confined at the moment to the weight classes. And there are a lot of, like, because the most fighters on the roster are either 170 or 155 pounds, you kind of need another option in there somewhere to spread that talent out. Like I said, like, there are guys in the top, you know, in the top 30 at welterweight and at lightweight that could be making up a top 15 of a different weight class, and we'd have another belt and we'd have, you know, more contenders, and, you know, I think it's got to come eventually. Did we get another question there, Jamie? I think we did.
Yeah, there's a donation from Carlos Almonte.
Nice one, Carlos. How does Oliveira do versus Islam's pressure? I think he absorbs it, to be honest. I think that's the best thing about Charles Oliveira's game, is that you, whatever you bring to him, he just kind of assimilates it and throws it back at you. If you want to come and trade strikes with him, then he'll quite happily hang in there. He'll take your best shots and he'll give you a couple back. If you want to take him down, then of course, you know, he has a whole plethora of options. And that's where this fight becomes even more interesting, really, is it's what does Makhachev choose to do? Does he feel like he wants to stand and trade with the Bronx? Because of course Oliveira's striking is formidable as well. Or does he want to wrestle with him and try and control him without getting submitted? Which, again, it would be very, very difficult to do. Not only because Charles Oliveira has such a depth of a game, but because he's able to go from one to the next to the next. As I was talking about with this a second ago. Like at this point, when he's on the back here, he's giving himself three options. He's got a reverse triangle. He can take his back if he frees Gaethje's left arm, or he can free Gaethje's head and take his right arm. Like three good options. At any point when he's tangled up with Makhachev, you know that he's going to have a few options on the table, and whether Makhachev can keep up with that quick fire submission attack, especially over five rounds, that's a question. I know he can wrestle. I know for sure he can wrestle. Watch Makhachev against Armin Sarukian. One of the best wrestling MMA matches you'll ever see. But this is a different thing. You know, you go down the card last night. You know, you watch Godinez against Carnelosi. And like V and I were watching it. And as we were watching it, I'm thinking to myself, and I said to V, there's no, like, Carnelosi needs to do something from the bottom. She needs to be aggressive from the bottom, because she's not going to be able to wrestle up and back out of this position. You know, a lot of people coming in against Makhachev, they will try and anti-wrestle, which involves wrestling, which is playing into his game. Oliveira will drop straight into a jiu-jitsu game, and that's a different look for Makhachev, and a very elite look for mixed martial arts.
We did have a donation from Veronica Macedo as well.
Oh, did we really?
Yeah, she asked whose picks were better.
You know, I don't know, to be honest, Jamie. I don't keep a leaderboard because, you know, that's not what it's about. But yeah, she did pretty good. She did pretty good. She had a few good picks. I honestly always forget the picks once we've made them. I think we both picked Jurny Newsom, but I think I went Godinez. But after that, I don't remember. I felt Oliveira was going to do it. I also thought Rose was going to win. I was leaning towards Tony as well because of... but he did look good in that first round. Anyway, you can't have your decision back. Me, yeah, of course. Okay, I reckon we should about wrap it up there because we're going to record the War Room right now for this week coming. Make sure you check out our sponsors for the podcast. So Outlaw Rum, outlawrum.co.uk, and I will be training in a moment and then getting into Rum Sundays. That is delicious. That's the flagship. That is the standard high quality Outlaw Rum. There's a couple of others as well. This is the double cask one, and I've got the Issei version in there as well. They are, I mean, each one of them, they're just, I mean, it is absolute quality. And our friends at canacarts.uk, find them on Instagram, give them a follow, canacarts.uk. If you use the code OutlawCBD, you'll get £5 off your order and you'll get free shipping in the UK. And it is, like I said, it is very, very clean and smooth, and there's no toxins, no nothing in it. This thing's made out of ceramic, which means that it's all good stuff. All right. Thanks for joining me for Aftermath. Give us a thumbs up. Give us a subscribe. Give us a like. Let us know what you think of the show. And we'll see you next time.